Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast available on your favorite podcast app or at thehollywoodoutsider.com. This is our annual episode where we dive into one of the largest film festivals in the world, the 2023 South by Southwest Film and TV Festival, complete with info from behind the scenes, reviews of over 25 film and episodic premieres, including Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, John Wick 4, Evil Dead Rise, Swarm, and a whole lot more. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today is my fellow host, Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
How are you today? Today we are going to talk exclusively about the South by Southwest Film Festival, or South By as it's commonly known, what the festival is, how it works, and especially what movies we saw that you should keep an eye out for. I want to mention we've done this before. We did the digital years. We've done the last like 10 some plus years of South by Southwest, and it was nice to be back. How about yourself?
Oh yeah, I mean, nothing compares to in-person South by Southwest.
You're not gonna tear up a picture of the priest, are you?
No.
That's an old joke. Nobody? Saturday Night Live? Nobody? Sinead? Nobody? Okay. On our Patreon, we will have a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff from the festival that we can't play or air here. So you can go to patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. That's patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. There's stuff that's going to be coming more over the next month, so keep an eye on that. I won't tell you what there is, but there's already some Dungeons & Dragons stuff, so go check that out. Amanda, can you tell people who've never been basically what this is?
So South by Southwest is one of the largest festivals in the country. It has film, TV, music, and interactive media. We're obviously only going to talk about the film and TV portion, which has all kinds of genres from comedies in film to what they call midnighters in the more like genre or horror films. So pretty much anything that you can imagine, and the same for television. They also have keynote speakers, special sessions, and panels with various parties in the industry, which you did go to a cool one. So we'll talk about that. And they even have a trade show. So there's a lot to do in South by Southwest.
I went to one what?
You went to a panel.
Oh, a panel. I thought you meant a party. I'm like, yeah. I don't really go to many parties. I was going to movies, man, every chance I got. Did go to a very cool Amazon Prime installation, though.
I was going to say, that one was awesome. The Amazon Prime had a lot of free drinks. Thank you, Amazon Prime. But also, they had all these, so all the shows they were trying to promote while they were there, like The Boys, Daisy Jones and the Six,
Harlem.
What else was there? Harlem. Yeah, they basically created a room themed for each show they were trying to promote. And they even had like the Country Music Awards, a section for that, which was funny. But it was a lot of fun because they tried to immerse you in one room into the world of these shows. And they had, you know, a DJ spinning some music on both sides of the world because they have two completely separate spaces. They had a bunch of food. They gave away free denim jackets that you were able to get customized by a local artist. Mm-hmm. So there was a ton in that. And that was insanely awesome for sure.
Also, I know, you know, I don't know if the kids are listening, but The Boys had a wall of apparatuses that were designed for your favorite hero. If you hit me up, Aaron at thehollywoodoutsider.com, and ask nicely, maybe I'll send you a picture of it. But there's a wall of apparatuses. That's all I'm going to say.
Or join the Facebook group.
Or join the Facebook group. Yeah, that picture was posted there. There's a lot of that kind of, it's called installations, but it's like an advertisement, but it's also very interactive, and it's meant for everyone. So the general public can come and join in. There was a Yellow Jackets one that we didn't get to go to. There was a Paramount Plus one. And that's so anybody that's part of the festival can go to these things and get let in and get to enjoy and partake in food, drink, and entertainment. There's a lot of entertainment flying around. So Austin is hopping this entire time. And it's always like a mid-March. There's a music festival right after this. There's like 2 weeks where Austin is nothing but movement. Okay, so let's get into it. How was South By for you this year? Like, how much did you enjoy? And I don't want to say just fun, because it is, I mean, it can, for us, it can feel a little like work because you're trying to go to as many movies as you can. But it is a lot of fun. So how was your South By this year?
It was fantastic. I mean, the best part about the festival, in my opinion anyway, is being able to interact with these films that may or may not ever get seen. Obviously, there are the bigger ones that are really enjoyable to watch with a group of people, a group of strangers. But my favorite part, especially this year, I feel like the audience was so engaged and reactive to every movie screening I went to, whether it was a really small indie film or it was, you know, a big blockbuster like John Wick 4. Every theater had such response and like outward response to the films while they were going on, which is really cool because it makes you feel like you're connected and like, oh, those random people, they laugh at the same jokes as me and they think that part's cool too. So it's like a good connection point.
Yeah, it's a sense of community, right? Because you're, to me, it's, to me, every time I've go, and this is, I think, I don't know, 10th, whatever the number is that I've been, my favorite part every year has been and always will be, I'm hoping always, has been that moment where you're in the line waiting for a movie. And I know that sounds nuts. Like, why would that be exciting to wait in line for a movie? But every single line for whatever you're going to see is filled with people who love movies just as much as you do. You know, everybody thinks they love them the most, but everybody loves them just as much as you do. And they're all in line talking about what they saw, giving you great ideas of things you want to see, kind of, you know, filling you in on things you couldn't see because there's so many movies and TV premieres. You can't catch them all no matter how hard you try. And just getting that vibe and that community from your fellow film and TV lovers is always my favorite part of the festival. It's why I always tell people this is the festival to go to. This is the one that you want to go to in the country, maybe the world.
Yeah, I'd agree.
All right. Well, before we go through what movies and events you saw and your takeaways on them, take us through what the festival is, why it's so huge from a fan's perspective, and why they should go. Other than you get to talk to cool fan and film buffs.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that part is always great, connecting with people, especially after we've had so much time to ourselves over the last number of years. But also, it depends on the type of person you are. So I'll give you kind of different fan perspectives. You've got the person who's going just for the movies, right? You're going to see movies, like I mentioned a little bit ago, that quite possibly could never be seen again. And if they are, more than likely not seen on a big screen with an audience. So that's a huge thing, mm-hmm. right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
You're seeing these incredible stories a lot of times, and especially I noticed this year, films that are a story that the director has a personal experience with, something that's very intimate to them. And so that part is really amazing. If you're a fan girl / fanboy, I guess the exciting part would be celebrities. I mean, they're going to come to the screenings. You're going to get to see how they interact with fans and hecklers, like Bruce Campbell flipping a heckler off and saying, get the fuck out of here. top experience, worst, but also very cool.
We'll have a little piece of that later on.
Absolutely. But if you're into that, you get that perspective. If you are the type of person who is always seeking knowledge and like new information, new perspectives, all of that, not only are you going to get that out of film and TV, which is, of course, part of the reason why we enjoy film and television, but you're also going to get it out of the panels and the people who are there sharing information, sharing new creative ideas. And when you have these Q&As with filmmakers after the screening, that part, I think, is also fascinating to everybody across the board, no matter what type of fan you are, because you get to get the behind the scenes perspective of why that filmmaker did specifically what they did. It gives people an opportunity to interact with these filmmakers who, you know, they've admired and idled for their entire lives or whatever it may be. And you also just, I mean, you get to kind of be part of that experience with the filmmaker. So there's so much to do, so much to see. As a fan, you have so many different opportunities and experiences. Another thing to it is you're never going to be able to see everything, right? Like South by Southwest has so much that occurs at the same time. You actually have to have like an internal debate about what's my priority going to be, this movie or this movie, this panel or this TV premiere. Like, what am I going to do? And I love that aspect of it.
Yeah, and one of the best things about all of that that you're talking about is that celebrities, yes, they're there. Filmmakers are also there. And in smaller films, to me, I think that's actually a lot more exciting than seeing Keanu Reeves, even though that's very cool, and Chris Pine, very cool, and Bruce Campbell. All right, well, nobody really tops Bruce Campbell for me, but all the other stuff is very cool. But when you go to a small...
Not even Dennis Quaid in the urinal?
Dennis Quaid wasn't in the urinal. It was Magnum P.I. that was in the urinal.
I know, but you could have had that opportunity had you gone back to pee once more.
I was peeing with Magnum P.I., young Magnum, not the elderly Magnum. And Dennis Quaid went to the restroom right after that. I could have been peeing with one of my favorite actors of all time. But yeah, even cooler than that. It's cool. I love the idea of going to a film with new filmmakers who are just excited that their film was made, that people are actually going to watch it, and they get to watch it with a packed audience, and they might never be seen again. They just never know how it's going to go at the festival. I love that. I feel like that's such an exciting moment. It's so fabulous when you get to see a film that nobody's ever heard of, and it just explodes. Like last year, Everything Everywhere All at Once, I mean, blew up, and now it's the Best Picture winner. One Best Picture while we're at the festival. Well, it debuted at the festival.
That was wild.
The year before. So yeah, it's insane. And they gave it proper credit. They made sure to say, hey, congratulations to the whole team at the festival in every screening, which was even cooler. So it's just, I mean, this festival's blown up over the years. It's so much different than it was 10 years ago. And it's become a nice mix of indie film, popular film, and every kind of fan. That's why I love it.
Well, we kind of talked about the distribution concept that there are going to be films premiering South by Southwest that have never been secured. They've probably never even been seen by an audience before. And so for anybody who hasn't listened to our South by Southwest episodes in the past,
shame on you.
They're known. Shame on you, indeed. South by Southwest is known for showcasing and premiering films and TV shows, often before they've even secured distribution. So talk a little bit about how the process at South by Southwest works.
All right. Well, shame on you. If you haven't listened to one before, you should. They're all there. Go back, listen to them. You'll hear Amanda and I, Brian Williams, Justin McCumber. A lot of great stories and tales have been told in many of those episodes. They're great ones to listen to. But the South by Southwest Festival happens every single March in the heart of Austin, Texas, minus a couple digital years we're not talking about. It showcases feature films, shorts, documentaries, episodic premieres, virtual reality projects, panels with your favorite filmmakers, influencers, and political advocates as well. Once you arrive, you can check in, you grab your badge, then you assemble your spreadsheet of planned events. If that's how you want to do it, you can use their app. Their app is actually pretty fantastic. And then you decide, what are you going to see? Are you going to see films? Are you going to see panels, keynote speeches, TV premieres, virtual reality? What are you going to do? Parties. There's a ton to do at South by. Always something to do. It never, ever stops. And you don't have to worry about if you missed a movie or a panel or you can't get into it, because that happens. That's part of, you know, this many people trying to go to these many things. There's always something else going on. So if you miss something or you don't get in, you just look at your schedule or your app and bam, you go do something else. It's a fantastic time. It's hectic. It's busy because you're always doing something. You don't really sit. You don't really rest. And I guarantee you, oftentimes what's happened to me is if I try to go to something and I can't get in, I often end up going to something better or something that, because oftentimes when you're going to something that you're disappointed you didn't get into, it's because you were familiar with it in some way, or something that really speaks to you. You like the genre or the description of the movie, whatever it was. And so you might end up going to something else and you might end up loving it. This year I went to the wrong freaking theater and I saw something completely different. So, I mean, anything can happen at South by. Anything can happen. Like, once again, they have a stellar app, but they also have this paper pamphlet that helps keep films and their schedules very organized. And I know it sounds stupid. Like, who wants to go back to paper? App's the way to go. Yeah, until you're trying to see a lot of things in one day and you have to, there are multiple theaters all over Austin and you kind of have to arrange your schedule. It's nice to see where the time blocks are laid out, like, in front of you.
Well, the thing I want to ask you about, Aaron, you've done South by Southwest more than anybody else for The Hollywood Outsider, obviously as the editor-in-chief and creator. But you've had some really cool experiences. You've had I mean, we've talked about them in the previous episodes, obviously the most iconic one being the Westworld experience that you had.
Oh, yeah.
And on top of all of the many films and projects and connections that have happened along the way. So my question is, what do you think could even top your South by Southwest experiences that you've had now? What are the things that could top the ones you've had before? Is there anything left that could top Westworld, for example?
Well, I mean, you get to basically live in that city. I mean, I don't know. Kiefer Sutherland was on site, and if he would have, you know, grabbed me by the throat and screamed, damn it, I think I would have been kind of in heaven. But that didn't happen. I don't know. I mean, I just kind of like taking it by surprise, and every year there's something where I'm like, that's going to be a memory I get to take with me. I didn't expect that. That's going to go with me. Didn't expect John Wick to debut there and Keanu Reeves to show up. I definitely expected Bruce Campbell to be there, but didn't expect to end up having a heckler just go wild and Bruce show why he's Bruce Campbell and shut that shit down. Nor me sleep in a lobby, basically, so I could go see him. All right. Well, let's talk about the movies we were able to see, as well as the experiences at the festival. What we're going to do is give a quick synopsis of each film, and Amanda and I will give their brief thoughts on the film and what the final score is. Remember, we rate every film at The Hollywood Outsider if $10 is the full price of admission, so 10 being the best. There will also be a few surprises along the way. I will tell you when we get there what they're going to be. But we're not going to go in any particular order. There'll be a little mini awards at the end of what we love. So here we go. So the first movie that we are talking about is called Bottoms. Wow. It has the best description, I think, of any movie at the festival. And it follows two unpopular girls in their senior year who start a fight club to try and impress and hook up with cheerleaders. It stars Rachel Sennott, A.O. Edebiri, Ruby Cruz, Havana Rose, Lou, and many more. So, Amanda, Bottoms. It's basically an 80s sex comedy, except it's for the queer generation.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much representation. And I hate to phrase it like that right off the bat, but like,
it should get praised. They don't make it a message movie. It's just a movie and they happen to
right,
be gay.
Right. Yeah. And what I love about it is that there's someone for you to connect or identify or laugh about because of your own personal experiences for every single person. So even if you're not queer, like, you're still going to have a good time. You're still going to have fun. It's not about, you know, it's not a preachy movie about that. It's a real, you know, raw, funny, hilarious, absurd comedy. And it's also about, you know, friendship and those relationships. And it's about, you know, taking risks, and it's about love, and it's about so many things. And I don't want to say that it's in the traditional vein of a coming of age tale. It has some of those elements to still draw those in who are attached to those types of stories, like myself, but also I think not deter people who are tired of coming of age stories like you.
Yeah, I don't like coming of age stories. I'll be honest. I'll tell you. Unless you got a new take on it, I get it. We've all come of age. No, this is just in batshit insane is what most of it is. I mean, it's got blood everywhere. There are broken bones. There are wounds. There are mortal wounds in this sex comedy. And it's hilarious. Like, throughout, there are sex toys. It's very much American Pie, but also a little bit of Fight Club. I don't really know what was happening, like, when they were writing this, going, how bonkers do we want to go? Like, do we want to make just the ultimate gay Fight Club movie? And they decided to go for it. Let's have sex jokes. Let's have wounds, mortal wounds. Let's do that. Let's get blood.
Wounds. They do get bloody, and it's so they bloody. Don't hold back. The jokes, they don't hold back from. The you know, fight scenes, they don't hold back from. They have so much fun with it. Not to mention the Fight Club school champion, liaison, whatever you want to call him, is Marshawn Lynch.
Oh, God.
Who is absolutely hilarious.
Marshawn Lynch should be an actor in more movies immediately. Immediately. He's hilarious.
It was It was amazing. Like, truly, I think there were a lot of people who were like, what the hell is he doing here? And you don't realize how much of a role he's going to play. Like, at first, I was like, oh, you know, we're going to get a glimpse of him. Ha, ha, ha. Move on. No, he actually has a real part to play in this film. And what I love about it is how absolutely ludicrous every single event in this story is, but how somehow it's still connected to a real life high school experience in some way, like something that we can still connect to.
And the guys are idiots. Just idiots.
Isn't that a nice, fun twist? I mean, you always have the dumb bimbo blondes.
Yep. The guys are the bimbos, you know, in this one. And I think that's hysterical. I think it's hysterical.
If we could have Chris Hemsworth play in this, we would be set.
He's a little too old.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. College, the sequel.
Yeah, but Rachel and Ayo are wonderful. They are absolutely wonderful. They are two best friends, and they just walk in lockstep. They're doing this for very different motives. One of them happens to love a girl. The other one just wants to get laid a lot. So it's your typical sex comedy. I mean, it's your typical sex comedy.
Well, if the full price of admission is $10, what did you give Bottoms?
I give Bottoms $7.50. What about you?
I'm not too far off. I gave it $8.50. I had so much fun with it, and I cannot wait to watch it again.
Excellent. I hope this gets a wide release. This is the kind of movie I want to see in an audience with a lot of people and a crowd. You know what I mean?
You had that, Aaron. We had that.
Well, I want everybody else to have it. I want everybody else to have it. I mean, I get that, no, and that's awesome for me, but I want people... to me, there's not much better than a comedy that everyone's on the same page with in a packed theater. And how often do we get that these days? We don't get it very often. You don't get comedies playing in movie theaters like that. There's something you don't get anymore, and we get it at South by. Bam, one more reason to go.
There you go. I think people were already sold, but if they're not, now they are.
Okay.
All right, so our next one is Talk to Me. And this is about a lonely teenager named Mia who gets hooked on the thrills of conjuring spirits through a ceramic hand. But when she is confronted by a soul claiming to be her dead mother, she unleashes a plague of supernatural forces. It's directed by Danny Filippu and Michael. It seems like they're related in some capacity. And then we have Sophie Wilde, Miranda Otto, Alexandra Jensen, and some others in here. Aaron, tell us your thoughts on Talk to Me.
Yeah, I think it's Filippo, Danny, and Michael. And look, this is a horror movie, first and foremost. These are emerging horror directors. This is a wild movie. The concept is they've created a party game out of a hand, right? And it seems like the hand is demonically possessed. So anyway, it sits down in a chair, they shake the hand, and they're going to see someone dead on the other side. And if they say the words like, let me in, or I allow you inside, or whatever, I can't remember the exact terminology, because I saw this one at the beginning of the festival, and there are a lot of movies after that. But when you allow the demon inside, you've got a certain amount of time before they take full control of one's body. And when that happens, a lot of different things can happen. And they end up making it a party game. And it seems like, oh, that's ridiculous. Who would do that? And my first thought was, everybody! Everybody that's a teenager, I mean, do you ever watch TikTok? Yes, they would do this, and they're filming it, and they're getting a lot of kicks out of it. And even though there's a kid at the beginning of the movie that gets killed over this, they still keep doing it. And it ends up just getting more and more amped up until it just goes just batshit crazy. And the whole movie is held together by Sophie Wilde, who stars as Mia. She's the lead. She's the one who lost her mother. She's really struggling. And she plays every facet of a person struggling with grief. She's happy, she's sad, she's miserable, she's angry, she's hurt, all of that. And she does a wonderful job. She carries the film. She makes the film terrifying when it's terrifying, and unnerving when it's unnerving, and also fun when it's fun. I really enjoyed it.
Again, full price of admission, $10. What are you giving Talk to Me?
$7. I give this one a $7. This is a horror movie I think everybody needs to pay attention to when it comes out.
Nice. That's a pretty good score. Mm-hmm. The next one that you saw is called Appendage, and this was written and directed by Anna Slakovic. I'm so sorry. And it stars Hadley Robinson, Emily Hampshire, which, if you don't know that name, you're about to know that name, especially after South by Southwest.
She's in three movies that I saw. Three freaking movies that I saw.
Yep. That Schitt's Creek is really getting her up
Good
and
for
out.
Her. Good for her.
She's a busy lady.
She's Stevie in Schitt's Creek, if you want to know her.
And this is about a woman named Hannah, and she hits a breaking point, and this is when her inner thoughts physicalize into a monstrous creature that threatens to upend her life. That sounds interesting. Tell us about it.
Okay. How do I talk about this one without ruining anything or spoiling anything? It's very basket case-y. It's there's a tumor, basically, a creature tumor, you know, an appendage that is essentially threatening to ruin Hannah's life because it's telling her to do bad things. And the deeper you get into the movie, the more the plot kind of takes a turn, which means I'm not comfortable telling you much more than that. I will tell you that Hadley Robinson does a fine job, and you know it's a solid movie, right? It's not great. I do think there's something to be said for the creature effects. I realize it's low budget, but they do not sell me on it as much as I would like. Personally, there are some moments where it's kind of hard to swallow. But on the same token, I like the idea. You know, I like the actors are all good. The direction's good. It's really just a creature effects thing. And I don't think it's bad. It does look a little Baby Yoda at times. You don't want a cute monster.
Oh, I get what you're saying.
And a little V the Final Battle. People listening that saw that, you know what I'm talking about.
So full admission price being $10?
$5.50. Solid watch. Nothing exceptional.
All right.
Okay. Now we're gonna go to one and I'm very curious about this one. Okay. So I heard good things about this, but you were very angry when you watched it. So I'm very curious about the whys. It's called Citizen Sleuth, and it's about a true crime. This is a documentary, right? Documentary?
That is correct.
Okay. A true crime podcaster from Appalachia blurs the line between fact and entertainment as she investigates a mysterious local death. What? You didn't care for this movie. Tell me why.
I cared for the original concept, just to put that out there. I think a different direction with this story and a more cohesive execution would have made this a fantastic documentary. So let me set the stage for you. Mm. This podcaster who in the documentary, is, you know, we follow from her perspective. So not only are we interviewing her, we're also observing her process as a podcaster. We're getting the story of how she got her podcast, you know, from something she was doing in her bedroom with zero experience, which they reiterate quite a few times, and turn it into something that has notoriety and fame attached to it. The original kind of conversation that you have with this podcaster is somewhat inspiring, where it's like, you know, you can take your passion that you've always had in your life, and even though you don't have like the degree or whatever it may be necessary to get the job you want, you know, let's say you want to be an investigator, you can still do that. But without having to go through all the schooling, you can do that in your house. You can do that and get paid. This is literally every podcaster's dream.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Yeah. Make this happen.
To make money off of what essentially is a hobby. Now, this podcaster, as I mentioned, and we start to take this direction where even her best friend is kind of making the joke about how this woman has zero relevant experience, zero training, zero pretty much anything. And they just kind of laugh about it. And it's like, ah, ha, 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 while this girl is getting a true crime tattoo done on her, this podcaster. And so as we're going along, so much of the quote unquote evidence that this woman is presenting feels valid. And we're starting to really buy into the story. This is, I think, a great direction so far in the documentary. Where it starts to take a head is when we find out that all of this evidence, quote unquote, that was there, which not only has fueled the individuals of her local small town where this happened, this murder, potential accident occurred, the city or town is like very passionate one way or the other, but this fuels them in a different direction where people's lives are quite literally at stake in terms of their reputation and where they can live and like all of these different things. So the people who are being accused of murder are really going through it. And it's fueled by this podcaster. Well, then we find out we don't really know if any of this evidence is valid. There's also a lot of evidence that tells us the contrary. So we go through this whole journey and from the one perspective, it's like, this is really cool to kind of see, you know, the impact that untrained, quote unquote, investigative journalists can have on real lives. Like, taking the podcast hobby aside from it, this woman's trying to solve a crime. She's getting involved with elected officials. She's getting involved with the police. She's getting involved in the families. Like, she has a personal relationship created with the mother of this girl who died. Oof. And so you can see how, like, oh, wow, this could really unravel things for this family, depending on where the evidence goes, you know, what our final conclusion is, whether this is valid or not. And the thing that really sucked about this whole documentary, and I had a conversation with another person who had also seen it, and he had similar frustrations, I guess, because this movie had so much great potential, is that that didn't seem to matter. Like, we continued to idolize this podcaster and treat her as though she's still some celebrity to admire for her quote unquote work without really taking, like, there wasn't a real conversation that happened other than my own internal thought for 20 minutes where I was like, man, they really missed the mark. They could have had a great conversation come out of this. And in some ways, I guess you could say it has, because we're talking about it. But I think the more important part, or the more appealing and entertaining element to the documentary where it had its original approach, is what are the consequences for people now listening to people who have zero knowledge, education, and experience on a topic, and how these personal true crime stories can affect a family's lives, the accused's lives. And that is like the really interesting story that we never got to. We got glimpses of it, but that's not what the documentary's focus was. And that's where they really missed their opportunity to make a great documentary.
That's too bad. I mean, that is too bad, because everything about it sounded fascinating to me. But I heard that from several people that they kind of built it up that, you know, she's doing good, but it's like they don't really address the bad. Is that kind of the way that I'm understanding it? Like, the damage that she
wreaks? I mean, they invited her to the premiere. And I will say she took ownership. She's taken ownership that she's made mistakes along the way. But to me, the optics of that felt really weird, because then you're not really you're not allowing your audience to be as fully critical to this individual as they realistically should. If that's the direction we want to take with the documentary. Instead, it felt more like this one podcaster's journey to stardom and how things got shaken up a little bit. Does that make sense?
It does, but it sounds like they did more damage than good overall, right?
It just frustrated me. I was like, you guys, I don't give a shit about this. You've not done enough to make me care. And the other thing too, and this is very subjective, this podcaster is not for everyone. The way she speaks, the way, you know, her demeanor is not necessarily for everyone. I would say that she can come off a little abrasive. She swears way more than I do, that's for sure. And so some people I could tell were turned off by her podcasting style. And so I think that also has some impact on opinions of the film too.
Gotcha. All right. So what's your score for Citizen Sleuth?
My score is $3.50.
Okay. I get it. Hey, guys, we've got a couple that are like, you know, you never know where they're going to be. And then we start going straight uphill. So it's all good. So just hang tight.
Yeah. So I know you're going to be excited to talk about this because you were excited to go to this.
I was.
But the online crime panel, which is kind of, from what I understand, cybersecurity, basically, with Robert Downey Jr.
Yes. Yes. That was pretty exciting. It was very cool to see Mr. Robert Downey Jr. And, you know, he had a panel of an FBI agent and some people from cybersecurity, including Aura Security, which is a company that he invested in, which is why he's there, because he cares about, you know, our cybersecurity, our online presence. And a lot of what the panel was talking about is stuff I think most people know, but sometimes you just need to be reinforced. And the idea that every time you do something online, you are inviting someone to get into your business, you know, to get all over you and steal your identity, steal your name. Billions and billions and billions of dollars were stolen last year. A lot of it was done from various seemingly ununderstandable crimes, like things we all know. Hey, don't click that email. Don't. If you get a phishing email, if you get an email from a Nigerian prince, they probably don't really need your money, and they're not waiting to give you $1 million. You know what I mean? So there's no way that works out well. And
if it's too good to be true, it is. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, and phishing has gotten very, very brilliant in the last few years. And they also they talked about how it works via phone. How it works via chat, how it works via email. I mean, how the various approaches that they take in order to get your information. The gentleman from the FBI really like broke down a lot of different scenarios, which was just fascinating. I mean, a lot of the stuff you just know, but you might not practice as much as you realize, because you don't think on how many people are alone in this world who just crave human attention. You know, especially the last few years, there's been so many people that are kind of stranded and just crave human attention. So their guards come down and they let people in just a little bit. And that's all people need. And when it comes to social media, all the information that people pour into social media, they don't realize that every inch of that is being combed through by internet sleuths, if you would. And they are checking all your data. You know, every time you put your birth date in something, someone is combing through that. Every time you get one of those Facebook quizzes or any quiz on anything, any social media. Hey, what's your mom's maiden name? Why would you ever tell anybody that? Why would you ever tell anybody your first dog? Why would you tell anybody, you know, certain things that would be linked to passwords? You know, that's what people don't pay attention to. And that's kind of what the panel was talking to. It was really fascinating. Interesting. I mean, ultimately, sure, he's partnered with Aura Security. So he's trying to sell Aura Security. But in the same token, he's trying to get through to people to say, hey, take a more serious, deeply thought out approach to your online presence.
Sounds fascinating.
It was great. It was a great panel. Yep.
Good. So you caught Riders on the Storm.
On accident.
Which was...
On accident.
This is the on accident one. Which was directed and produced by Jason Motlaw and Mark Altmans. It is about a young horseman battling to make his name and keep a family tradition alive in the ancient sport of Buzkashi, learns that fame is a gift and a curse as the Taliban take control of Afghanistan and threaten his life. Mm-hmm. Sounds dramatic.
Yeah.
Is this a documentary or a narrative?
Yeah, it's a documentary. First, I'm going to explain how it's an accident. So I'm going to see Leah McKendrick's movies, Scrambled. Now, if you're a longtime listener, you might remember that name. She was the screenwriter for MFA, which also was part of South by Southwest, which is my favorite movie of that year. I absolutely love that movie. She came on the show, interviewed her, love her. I was wanting to support her film. And so I get to the showing where they have like several screenings, and there was a mad rush because of the times that were very close to each other. And they gave me a ticket and told me which theater to go to. And I go to the theater and I gave them the ticket and they let me in. So I sat down, assuming I'm in the right theater, because I'm at the theater they told me to, and I gave them the ticket, and the ticket said Scrambled on it. So it didn't say Riders in the Storm. But about 15 minutes before Scrambled was supposed to start, the lights go down. And I'm like, oh, are we starting early? Nope. I'm at Riders on the Storm. And at that point, I'm not about to leave and, you know, hurt the filmmaker's feelings or anything like that. So I'm like, I'll sit through it. And plus, this has been, not necessarily this situation, this has never happened before. That's a fluke. But I've had situations where I couldn't get into one thing, so I went to another thing, ended up being a great experience. So I'm willing to check it out. It's fascinating. It's an interesting concept. So I'm of two minds on the actual film. Okay. So one mind of it is this is an extremely well done documentary. It really does capture this particular sport of bokashi, which is very popular in Afghanistan. I think if you go watch Rambo 3 years and decades ago, you'll see this sport being played. And how the game works is you ride horseback. There's multiple players riding horseback, and they take a dead goat and they're swinging it around trying to get it in a circle. And if you get it in a circle, you get a point. So it's like soccer with a dead goat and horses. So this is where my second...
That sounds ethical and humane for American standards.
It's Afghanistan. It's Afghanistan. It's not America. And the Taliban does very much get involved in threatening their lives and trying to influence how they... Because the Taliban has taken over Afghanistan. So it really gives you insight into how Afghanistan is run as a country as of now and how much influence they have over the country and the threats of violence that they still offer, even though they say that they don't. So that gives you a deep insight into the country. So that's the one mind. The one mind is an extremely well done documentary, and it really does showcase both this sport, the players who play it, and how the Taliban affects those playing the game. My other mind is the animal lover in me, the mild hippie, that can't stand watching any of this because I think it's cruel and I have a really, really hard time with that. So that's where I struggle. I think if the film itself is very well done, for me personally, I can't watch it again ever because it's just, I mean, dead goats and the horses there at every instance, there's a chance those horses could be, you know, break a leg and be put down. And for what? I'm like, and all these years, nobody, all that money that we poured into Afghanistan, nobody could buy him a fucking ball. Like, why are we throwing goats around? I don't understand. Like, this is the solution. I don't get it. I don't care how.
They said, Winston is gone, my guy. We can't afford to like be.
Understand. I get tradition and everything, but can you get a football, wrap it up in some net and give it to him or something? Like, why are we throwing dead goats around? I don't understand. But anyway. So for the film, if you're someone who's this appeals to, I would say it's probably about a 750. For me, it's about a 5 because the sport itself is very difficult for me to get past. But from a critical standpoint, it's a much better film than that.
Oh, that was a good review, critical review.
And I still haven't seen Scrambled. So Liam McKendrick, if you're listening, I'm going to reach out. We're going to get a screener link. I still want to talk about that one. All right. Brooklyn 45. So this is what Amanda saw. In the months following World War II, 5 old military friends are talked into an impromptu seance, which brings to troubling light each of their haunted pasts. It was directed and written by Ted McGeegan, and the cast is Anne Ramsey, not Anne Ramsey from Throw Mama from the Train, because she did, but a different Anne Ramsey. That's an older reference for older people. Ronnie Raines, Jeremy Holm, and many others. So tell me about this movie, Brooklyn 45, which I believe is going to Shudder eventually.
It is going to Shudder. It was supposed to go to Shudder last year, but it looks like maybe they held off for South by Southwest. Excellent. Or something.
That's cool.
I don't know. We'll see. It's supposed to go to Shudder. The poster is a Shudder original, so it's going there someday. But this one is interesting because it doesn't start like they're coming together to do a seance. It's, hey, guy whose wife died recently. You're struggling. You asked us to all come here. We're good friends. We were all in the military in some capacity.
Simplify.
And let's see how you're doing. Let's talk. Let's, you know, what's going on? And he's like, haha, just kidding. You're here for me to talk to my dead wife.
What?
We got goals tonight. Yeah. And so they're all kind of like, well, shit, man, I don't know if I should do this. This doesn't seem like a good idea. One guy is like, I don't believe in this. Another person's like, I believe in this too much. And things go really crazy.
I like this so far.
It gets wild. Things get really crazy when their friend who brought them there starts the seance. Things go crazy. All of a sudden, he's not in the picture anymore, and they have to figure out how they're locked into this room now. Why are they locked into this room and why can't they leave?
Oh, and it's like the first escape room.
It is with ghosts. So I will say, if you're thinking there's going to be a ton of ghostly interaction like Ghostbusters, it's not that deep. It's more about
it's going to be like Ghostbusters. Why would I think Bill Murray's going to show up with a lightsaber?
I'm just saying, like, from the ghost perspective, they're very limited in that. You do have some ghost interaction. You can tell they've put some effort into physical effects, but also some special effects. And they've also taken the time to develop the character story of what's going on, because there's a lot of things that continue to unravel. And the times, because remember, this is shortly after World War II, are incredibly relevant to the story as well. And so there's, if you're somebody who's a fan of history who, you know, was very, Nazis suck, which we're all Nazis suck, but if you're really into seeing that on a film, this is also for you. Even if you're maybe not into ghosts or the paranormal, the ghosts that you're seeing here are not, I won't say that they're not scary, honestly. They can come across as though they're trying to be scary, but the way that the film is made is not intended to scare the audience. It's more your journey with these characters and all of these other side, I don't know, plot twists that occur to kind of keep the ball rolling. So I really enjoyed it from that perspective. I'm not a big history buff, but it's not like we were super ingrained into that world by any means, but it does play a very relevant piece to the characters and to the story. So it was pretty interesting. And I think you should definitely check it out on Shudder, but just don't go into it expecting to be scared, because that's not what you're going to get.
Okay. And score?
So for this one, I gave it 550. So it's above average. I liked it. I think, you know, usually there's more of a impactful climax. I think that's really where it faulted for me. And they could have made some improvements as making that more intense and powerful. But overall, I liked the movie. So
I just like whenever anyone says impactful climax. Okay, so the next one is Self-Reliance.
All right, so this was written and directed by the man, Jake Johnson. I love him.
I didn't know he was the man, but all right.
He is. He's also in the cast, along with Anna Kendrick and Andy Samberg, Wayne Brady, Emily Hampshire again. Here's her second film that you saw. Mm-hmm. And given the opportunity to participate in a life or death reality game show, one man discovers there's a lot to live for. That's kind of vague. Tell us more about it.
It's a wild concept. This is actually Jake Johnson's writing or directing debut. This is the first film he's directed. It's very indie in its scope, but it's a good movie. Like, it's a really interesting movie. What happens is he's basically, I wouldn't say kidnapped, but he's a guy that's going nowhere, right? He's just kind of like living his lamest life. He can't get over his ex-girlfriend and that sort of thing. And then one day Andy Samberg shows up as Andy Samberg. He's actually Andy Samberg, which is even more hysterical. Gets him in a limo.
What?
Yeah.
Hold on. Yeah. So they don't have Andy Samberg showing up being an idiot as Joe. It's Andy Samberg being an idiot as Andy Samberg.
He's actually not an idiot. He's an actor, Andy Samberg, who talks Jake Johnson's character into getting into a limo and drives him to an abandoned warehouse. And there he finds a couple of rich guys that basically said, hey, guess what? We have a game and you can win $1 million if you can live for the next 30 days. And it's like, wait, what? The deal is you have to live for 30 days. But throughout these 30 days, there's always going to be assassins coming to kill you. You're being hunted this entire time. You don't know where they're coming from. You don't know when they'll show up. There are certain rules, which means if you're in close proximity to anyone, they will not kill you. So he thinks he can rig the system. He can game the system. Huh? And as long as he stays close to people, then he won't die. So he's just, but the thing is like people, number one, don't believe him. Number two, don't want to spend that much quality time with him. So he has to figure out how to stay alive when his family doesn't really want to bond with him that heartily. He ends up actually picking up a homeless guy and paying him to stay with him at one point, which leads to some of the best jokes in the movie, because he starts to actually become really good friends with this guy, with this homeless dude. And also Anna Kendrick pops up as another contestant, potentially. Is she? Is she not? You don't know. And, you know, so there's a lot that goes into that. So it's a game show. It's like Hard Target, but if it was told from the mindset of Jake Johnson. So he's being hunted by rich people, but it's more for laughs than violence.
Interesting.
It was pretty good.
And what's your score for this one?
650. This is one of those, it's very low key, but it's fun. And I think an interesting concept, personally. Okay, so you saw also Love and Death, which is a TV premiere, and it might be familiar because there was a Hulu thing called Candy with Jessica Biel, very similar to this last year. But this has someone you love, Elizabeth Olsen.
Yes, 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 okay. Yes.
Two church-going couples enjoying small-town family life in Texas until somebody picks up an axe. Now, did you see one episode or two episodes of this?
Two episodes, the first two episodes.
Comes to HBO Max on April 27th. Jesse Plemons is also in this, and Patrick Fugit, Kristen Ritter. Tom Pelfrey's in this. Oh, I love Tom Pelfrey. So tell me, is this show, I never saw Candy. I don't really know the story. Is this show interesting? And showrunner is David E. Kelley, so you know he's got a great track record.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I had no idea about the story, because this is a true story. This is based on a true tale. And I never saw Candy either, so I don't have that comparison to make. But from what I understand, the direction of that show is different from what I saw in Love and Death. And the one thing that I really enjoyed about, you know, that first initial episode and then the transition into the second episode is that we get to really understand these two couples and the two individuals who then will they, won't they affair starts to occur. And so they're very, I don't know, inviting and like warm in some way, where we really start to root for these characters, you know, in both of their marriages. It's kind of like, oh, they're clearly not that happy. You know, it's one of those where it's, you could see both of them being happier, and this spark of a moment that occurs between them that maybe ignites a will they, won't they affair situation is very minute, which I thought was kind of an interesting element to include, and how fast this roller coaster progresses. And once you know, in the log line, you have the description and the synopsis of until someone picks up an axe. So what you don't know is 100% who picked up the axe, who was axed, and why they were axed. You have presumptions. You have your own conclusions that you've come to. But at least by the end of the second episode, unless you already know the story, you still don't have a full understanding of where it's going in terms of, you know, you don't have all the information yet. And that, I think, is really fascinating, the approach that they took to building that. Now, speaking of performances, Elizabeth Olsen and Jesse Plemons, honestly, if you would have asked me before the premiere, do you think this is going to work? I would have said, absolutely not. And that is no offense to either of them. I just don't see that chemistry happening. Somehow, some way, these fantastic actors who have such a dynamic to their characters and their performances, both of them do, where it's like, wow, I was thoroughly impressed, because I could, you know, I could at least try to find my way into their romance story of why they're potentially interested in each other, which even at the beginning of the episode, I did not think I would. So I give a lot of credit to the cast, because they're such strong leads, and they have such, when I talked about their dynamic performances, we see them as great people, but everybody has flaws. And so when we start to see those flaws, and how they're presented in their character is like, I loved it. It was fantastic, because epitomized both aspects for both of their characters. Really well done show in terms of production as well. I mean, it's HBO Max. It's not going to look bad or anything. Highly recommend it. I would encourage you to go in as blind as possible. Don't look into the story. Don't look into any details. Don't read anything about it. Just go watch it.
Okay. And what's your score on Love and Death?
8 out of 10.
All right. I want to watch that. I do.
April 27th, you can.
I will come April 27th. That's about a month.
The Long Game, directed by Julio Quintana. And it also stars Jay Hernandez, who we talked a little bit about.
I peed Dennis next Quaid. To him.
Did not pee next to Dennis Quaid.
Did not.
Sad. And so sad for you. Banned from playing at the club where they caddied, a group of Mexican-American high schoolers from their own golf team build a one-hole course in the fields and win the 1957 Texas State Championship against all odds. This is based on a true story.
Yes, I love this movie. This is one I wanted to see, but I didn't. I only wanted to see really because Dennis Quaid's in it, and I'm a big Dennis Quaid fan. I have been for most of my life, and I knew a little bit about this story. My wife's Hispanic, so I've actually heard this story before, and I really didn't know the details. Watching the film, it's such a crowd pleaser. It's like one of those sports movies that's more about the characters than it is the sport. You know, the sport's there and you get an appreciation for why people love golf and what golf means to certain people and how it can be a means to get out of poverty if you're very good at it. But really it's a story about the characters, and Jay Hernandez's character is trying to be seen as an American. You know, he served his country. He went to war. He did all these things, and still he can't play on the golf course as a member. And he wants to be a member of an exclusive club. They keep telling him, hey, you know, go to a lesser club. So he ends up putting this team together of talented young caddies to win a championship. The idea is to show them that they belong. And Dennis Quaid is his friend and former mate in war, who helps him get going, because unfortunately he needs a white guy to get them going. You know, it's that time when people of different colors were not accepted for anything other than service work, so to speak. So it's a very interesting story. I haven't seen it told before. It's very well done. It's funny. It's human. It's beautiful. You get to really feel for the kids a lot, because the kids are, they're Mexican Americans, and they don't really fit in America. They go to Mexico. They don't really fit in Mexico. They're stuck in the middle. And I've seen that with my own eyes, with my own wife. So it's an interesting dynamic. They really capture it. It's a beautiful film. Very funny. Great talent. This is one of my favorites from the festival, The Long Game.
Awesome.
And I give it $8. Okay. Then we moved into a work in progress. This is not a finished film. And I would say I could tell that because there's some ADR from Ben Affleck that I'm like, I think they might want to redo that a little bit, because it didn't feel like it was done. But overall, it's a pretty complete movie, Hypnotic. Would you not agree?
Absolutely agree.
Okay. Well, what it is about is a detective becomes entangled in a mystery involving his missing daughter and a secret government program while investigating a string of reality-bending crimes. It stars Ben Affleck, Alice Braga, and of course, Willem Fichtner, who I also ran into in the men's room. It's wild.
Apparently the men's urinal in particular, is the place to be.
He was also a very nice guy. So people are nice in the men's room. Just saying. Wish we were in Dennis Quaid there. But it's directed and written by Robert Rodriguez, who is beloved in Austin, Texas. Just him showing up got a round of applause. Before we talk about the movie, I want to talk about Robert Rodriguez.
Let's talk about him.
Okay. And we'll have a little bit of a snippet from his Q&A here in a little bit. But I want to ask you, after the movie's over, he basically did a wonderful thing where he started asking people to share memories of his movies with him, because it was the 30th anniversary of when Al Mariachi debuted. And he gave anyone that gave an answer he loved a signed poster and also a trip to his studio, which was pretty fabulous. Amanda tried very hard to get me to do it, and I just I just don't
I
like
did.
It. Just not me. I don't like attention on me. So Amanda, wasn't that awesome?
Oh my God, it's so cool. So the reason he's so beloved in Austin in particular, I mean, he is by many people, but Austin and South by Southwest in particular, because not only has he participated in South by Southwest over the years, he's done a lot to bring his films and make sure he has something to bring to the table, even, you know, doing workshops and things like that. You can go listen to one of our older episodes. I think we have a snippet from him in there. If not, we talk about his movie, Red 11. But he has his production company in the area, in Texas, and he does a lot of filming in Texas. He incorporates the Austin Film Society. So he does a lot to intertwine that network of aspiring filmmakers into his journey as a filmmaker. The other thing that I really appreciate and respect about him is that realistically, he could do all of this without people who are new to it. And he takes it upon himself to help put other people on the platform and give them the tools and resources they need to become a filmmaker like him. And I just have so much admiration for him. But what he did with that was really cool, because not only were they posters that, you know, were signed and everything, but they're original, authentic. So if you said that El Mariachi was your favorite, you're getting an original. I think that was one of them that actually didn't have an original. I can't remember. But you're getting an original poster. For Alita, which was really cool, not only do you have the signature, do you have the tour, all of that stuff, but also he's apparently got Jim on speed dial. So add that one to your poster.
Jimmy Cameron. Yeah. He's getting a Japanese poster signed and mailed to somebody. Yeah, it's awesome.
It's so cool. I mean, and it was not done in a way of like, tell me I'm a good filmmaker. Tell me why you like me.
You tell me the best story about me, I'll give you stuff. It wasn't like that at all. It was, you could see the love. You could feel it.
Yeah. It was like his way to engage with his fans, give them an opportunity to like share a personal story to them. And for him to also, I mean, as a filmmaker, you want to hear about the impact your movies have made over the years. And, you know, hopefully it inspires filmmakers. And that was another thing he did, was he specifically tried to find someone who was an aspiring filmmaker in the audience so he could bring them on set. And there was a guy who, you know, talked about it. People offered their like films and stuff to him, like, here you go, guy. And he took it. He was a nice guy. But he also invited this guy to be behind the monitors with him through the next filming he does. And I'm like, this is wild. This guy is going to get murdered by a creepy stranger at some point. Sure.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So the movie, what did you think of Hypnotic?
You know, I really liked it. And there was, first of all, it was very emotional. There were a lot of parts. Ben Affleck is such a tremendous actor. And sometimes I forget how good he is, because in so many ways, he's the same guy a lot of times. But he has such an intense personality that draws you in and makes you feel the emotions he's feeling. And I really love Robert Rodriguez's filmmaking style and his use of close-ups and things like that to get the emotion out. And I really, and I won't say anything about it because I think you should know as little as possible going into this film, I really appreciated the turns in this story. Like, where we started is not at all where I thought we were going to end up, if that makes sense. Or where we ended up is not at all where I thought we were
going to end up. Yeah, it totally makes sense. I mean, the crimes are very much a mind bender. I would say it's difficult to tell you too much because you really don't want to ruin anything. And he asked the audience to please keep a lot of it to ourselves. So I will do that. It's very, I'm just trying to give you a vibe, right? An Inception-y vibe. How about that? It's just like you really got to think.
Yeah, it's something that's going to turn the wheels in your head
a little bit. And I will tell you, like, for the first, I'm glad that the movie played out the way it did, because the first half, I'm like, well, that's a plot hole. But the plot holes make sense as the movie goes on. I'm like, okay. And I thought it was, there's a lot of very clever stuff in this movie. And the last third actually makes everything before it work so much better. So I did enjoy it as well. It is work in progress, like Amanda said, or like I said, one of us said it. So, I mean, there will probably be some tweaks before it comes out, which I believe is going to be later in the fall of this year. But it's called Hypnotic. And I give it $6.
I gave it $6.50.
All right. And William Fichtner, good guy too. Good guy.
30 years after El Mariachi, I feel like I'm in the shoes that you were in back then. What would you tell yourself back then? What do you know?
The main thing is to start. A lot of people say, you know, even when I talk to people and tell them my whole thing, they'll go, gosh, that's so inspiring. You know, I kind of have a project that's actually got most of the elements together, but I'm not sure if I'm ready. And it's like, the thing I've learned the most is that art is very much like life. You're not ready for life.
Yeah.
You go, I'm going to go to work today. I'm going to do this and that. And you go and your battery's dead, or your mom's in the hospital, or you just got your job taken away. And what do? You roll with it. You're not ready. You roll with it. But yeah, when it comes to art, sometimes people think, for some reason, they have to be ready.
Yeah.
If I waited till I was ready, that would be on my tombstone. Here lies Robert Rodriguez. He was never ready. You don't know that. You have to, you're never going to feel ready. And that's when you start. Because you actually are not going to be ready until you're like midway through the project. That's when you get ready, actually, is through it. So it seems counterintuitive, but counterintuitive works. I'm not ready, that means it's time to start. And if you just start, momentum will take over. You'll come up with stuff as you go. You'll figure it out. You'll go, okay, I've got 34 days instead of 55 days. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to figure it out as we go.
Yeah.
So I would just tell myself that. Remember to always just start. And you, Miss Planet Terror. Give me a Planet Terror original poster. Actually, it's a double poster. It's going to have... it's the Grindhouse one, so it has Death Proof on there too. You have to come to the studio office. We're going to give them the information because Grindhouse has so many props in my studio and even some of Quentin's cars, like the Vanishing Point car and all that. It's at the studio here. You're going to get to see it.
All right, you saw Mrs. Davis, which is a new show. I believe it's coming to Peacock on April 20th. And this is comes from Tara Hernandez, and I believe Damon Lindelof is behind this as well. Captain, no ending. Mrs. Davis is the world's most powerful artificial intelligence. Simone is the nun devoted to destroying her. Who you got? Stars Betty Gilpin, Jake McDormand, and Annie McQueen. Betty Gilpin is somebody we've raved about repeatedly on this podcast. Love her. Go watch The Hunt.
Yeah.
Go watch Glow. She's great. How about Mrs. Davis?
I mean, if you're a fan of Betty Gilpin and anything else, you're going to love her here. She is the opposite of, in so many ways, of what you would anticipate to be a nun. The opening, I will tell you, because I don't want to tell you much about this show. I will say it's going to get very sci-fi-y. It's going to start to go in a lot of really weird directions. And if you're not prepared to keep your mind open to the possibilities of where this is weirdly going to go, you're not going to have a good time with it. So have an open mind and, I don't know, sit down for the ride, I guess. But the first episode, because we saw the first two, first episode was so much better than the second episode. The first episode, at least for me, I was much more engaged with it, had much more action. There's an opening action sequence, which is phenomenal. So much fun. The entire audience was, whoa, just fantastic. And you kind of really start to think about AI and technology and this one woman who's like, nah, screw this. And the AI, the woman, is like, nah, I want to talk to her. I'm going to find a way using my technological ability, because I'm connected to everybody else in the world, to find a way to get her to communicate to me, even if it's through someone else. And they have like a lot of their own terminology because in this world, the AI is kind of like a Bluetooth ear pod, and you're just hearing what it says there, and then you can communicate to this person because she's refusing to speak to you one-on-one. And so it's a really interesting approach to this conversation and why there's nuns. Hopefully we find out all the details to that. I can tell you right now, I don't have a good conclusion to a lot of the questions that will occur by the end of episode two. I have zero, matter of fact.
Okay.
So
interesting.
It's weird. It's bizarre. It's fun. Betty Gilpin, I think if you had put somebody who was not as engaging and wasn't as well-rounded in her range, where she can be sweet and charming, but she can also be a badass woman to her core, you know, this probably wouldn't work as well. She really holds, she's the glue that holds it together. So I give it $6.
Okay. Now we move on to, I think, both of our favorite movie of the festival.
Yes!
Spoiler alert. This was what's known as a secret screening, which means they had a block of time that was kind of allotted, and it's just called a secret screening. And if you're lucky enough to get in, you get to see a movie, and it turns out that it was John Wick Chapter 4, which is in theaters March 24th. Chapter 4 wastes no time and immediately introduces the major villain of this story in the Marquis, who is Bill Skarsgård. He's fantastic. He carries with him the full weight of the High Table, that clandestine organization in which John Wick has slighted in the bloodiest of ways and now appears to be represented by Clancy Brown. The Marquis' mission is to extinguish not only John Wick himself, but the very idea of the Baba Yaga. To do so, he enlists his side beast, Killa, who's Scott Adkins, a ton of assassins, as well as Wick's friend and former associate, Kane, who's played by Donnie Yen. Along the way, John Wick gets a little bit of return help or interference, depending on who you are, from Winston, Ian McShane, Sharon, which is Lance Reddick. We miss you.
It's so heartbreaking.
Sorry, we miss you. Love you. That's a little bittersweet, but Lance Reddick's last role in the John Wick movie. Well, I think he might be in Ballerina. I don't know that spinoff. But anyway, Lawrence Fishburne's King is back. A few new and old friends. And of course, the manager of the Osaka Hotel, Shimazu, who's a legendary, Hiroyuki Sanada, and his daughter, Akira, who is pop star Rina Sawayama. So, John Wick Chapter 4, Manda. I already spoiled that we liked it a lot. What'd you think?
This movie was nuts. I also think it was one of the more comedic films of the franchise. It's, I would say, probably my second favorite in the franchise.
Which one's your favorite?
The first one, really? Is okay. my favorite. Yeah, it just, I'm more driven by the emotional story than I'll ever be by action. And so the impact of that first one and seeing his character, Keanu Reeves' character, progress.
I get it.
Yeah, it is a dog. Let's be honest, it's a dog. But somehow, I don't know how they do this, but somehow they always manage to up the ante with each of these John Wick films. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree
like,
with that.
Like, yeah. Somehow the choreography, the stunts, the just all around balls to the wall shit that's going to occur continues to elevate and get crazier and get funner and everything else in between. And this is no exception by any means. John Wick is phenomenal. I loved the rivalries that occur here. There's a lot of semi-new characters that are introduced on screen for us that we get to have fun with. And I will never look at Stairs the same again.
Oh, there's a great Stairs bit. And actually, fun side note, I won't tell you what happens, but Keanu Reeves reenacted the moment on the stairs on the stage when he did his Q&A. Via
so
his
funny.
Hands. So once you see the movie, just picture that scene with Keanu Reeves reenacting it with his hands. And it was, you'll have it in your head. It's pretty funny. Here's what I would say.
If not, I think I have a video somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure you do. Make that a TikTok, Amanda. What are you doing? Once the movie comes out. So it's a 3-hour movie, or almost 2 hours and 49 minutes. And when I first heard the runtime, I'm like, hell no. I love John Wick. I don't think this is going to be excess. It's going to be too much. Director Chad Stahelski, who has done all the John Wick movies, and I think David Leitch helped him with the first one, but he's done Solo since then. He's a former stuntman. He knows stunt choreography. he's also finally mastered audience patience, because even though it's almost 3 hours long, I never felt that time. I never felt like it was too long. I felt like I was in John Wick's moment the whole time. I was following him on his path, on his mission. There are, I want to say, three or four elongated fight scenes, like just set pieces that go on for like 20 minutes. I mean, it's insane to me.
And it never gets old. No, it doesn't. Like, those 20-minute scenes do not get old. Yeah.
Always feels fresh. New kinds of weapons. Nunchucks show up here. I mean, there's horses. There's cars. There's everything. There's stairs. There's everything you could imagine as a weapon is used in this movie. And it's just fantastic. And I got to be honest, if this were the last one, I think they ended on a masterstroke. Like, I feel like, you know, I know a lot of people are going to be clamoring for John Wick Chapter 5 and all that stuff, and we need six more of these. I don't. I feel like this is a masterpiece of action cinema. I absolutely love this movie. It's, man, I was so close to just giving it a 10. And I probably didn't, just because I want to see it again before I go that high on something. But it's so close to me. I mean, it's just a hair away from perfection in terms of an action film. And, you know, you go in for the first movie to the second to the third. All three of those had moments where it was a little bit of a lull. There's some section of those films where I'm like, okay, this is boring. Or it had Ruby Rose. That never helps. But this one doesn't have that. There's not a moment where I feel like this doesn't work, which is just insane for a fourth movie. Absolutely loved John Wick Chapter 4. I give it 9.5.
Chad Stahelski knows what he's doing at this point. He's got it down to a T. Let's give him some more opportunities to get into a movie with Jason Statham. I don't know, start a franchise with him. That'll be fun. Phenomenal film. Really enjoyed it. A lot of fun. Action is outrageous. I gave it 9. And I think, Aaron, you have potential to get your name on a box or something from Lionsgate.
I don't know about the box. I don't think it'll be in a box.
Some of the marketing
they
somehow
are using a couple quotes from my reviews in their worldwide
not
marketing.
Your favorite.
So I don't know where or when or why or whatever, but at some point, whether it be social media or TV spots, my name's gonna pop up next to John Wick. Just saying. I think that means I get to fight him if he makes another movie. That's the deal.
Tell everyone your favorite quote from your review, which you should check out at thehollywoodoutsider.com.
My favorite quote. So they said
he's so sad about it.
I am. Just so you guys know, if you're a film critic, when they use your quote in advertising, they usually ask for your permission. And the reason that they do that is they want to make sure before they go and market it, because they don't want to take things too far out of context. And I've actually said no to quotes before because they've tried to use them on it. Like, take a quote, but try to make it a positive. And I'm like, no, that's not you're not selling a movie with that, because I did not like that piece of shit or whatever. But usually it's, you know, they want to market their movie and I get it. So in my written review, I had two quotes. Pushes the boundaries of what's possible in film is one that they wanted to use, and a fantastic action film, one that we might not see again for the rest of our lives, or something along those lines. But I had a quote in there that I thought was great. I was so proud of it. And I said, this movie is akin should forever from now on be known as the Gunfather, because this film's an offer you can't refuse. And I thought, that's clever as hell. Why is no one wanting that? That's the quote you want, but that's not what they wanted. The Gunfather. Come on. Yeah. That's great. Nobody wants it.
It's gold.
Nobody wants it. That's what happens when you try to be too clever. The rest of the world goes, no.
Mm-mm. You're trying too hard. You did too well. We don't want to rub that ego. Calm down, sir.
Good. Keep me down to earth, just like Keanu Reeves, who, guess what? You're going to hear him from a snippet of the Q&A. And if you go to South by Southwest, you get to hear stuff like this yourself.
That was really special. And then also just making the film, like, you know, after a few years coming back to see, you know, Ian McShane and Lawrence and work with this man again, you know, so it's almost like the alpha and the omega, and then everything in between. I don't know, man, what's your favorite?
For me, it was the first day. There was a scene on the movie. It was the first day Keanu came on set. He had the suit back on. It was the first time we've been back together in 3 years, so it was pretty special.
Hi, my name is Carter. I have a question about the house scene and how long that took. Also, did you shove like a fireworks sparkler into that shotgun?
That's an actual round of ammunition called Dragon's Breath.
I know that. It's just, how was it not lethal?
We have a very good stunt team and a very good visual effects team. Some of the best in the world. The whole sequence, we did the entire sequence in the top shot in 3 days, and the apartment in a week. Again, we have a very, very good
and
team.
And months of planning. And training. Yeah.
A lot of training.
He's a god. He's a god amongst men. One of the kindest, sweetest men.
A handsome god.
Did you say handsome god? Is that what you said?
He's a handsome god. Also, someone tried to propose to him.
Oh my god.
During Speaking the screening. And I love that he was so sweet and humble. His response was, "Be careful what you wish for. You don't want that. You don't want that." And I'm like, stop. We all want it. Every man, woman, being, animal in this room would take you up on that, Mr. Reeves.
You think there's animals in that room? I mean, like, there's a dog section because it's a John Wick movie.
Honestly, I was waiting for them to bring a set of dogs, like any dogs that were in this film, onto the stage and, like, just get everyone excited. And I waited and I waited and I waited and I looked at Keanu and then I waited and then I looked at Chad and then I waited and I looked at Keanu again and never were any dogs present.
Well, I look forward to seeing Keanu. He confirmed he will be in Ballerina, the spinoff with Ana de Armas. So that's exciting. And Chad Stahelski is next doing Ghost of Tsushima, which is one of my favorite games of the last 10 years. So it's a dedication to Japanese culture. I can't wait to see what he does with that. That's going to have some fantastic action as well.
Also, if you are the guy who is in the audience who kept yelling your thoughts, please don't do that. Don't be that guy.
Yeah, nobody needs that.
Your thoughts can stay in your head during the movie. That's okay.
But if you ever want to hear how loud an audience can get from Keanu Reeves saying, yeah, go to South by Southwest and see John Wick Chapter 4 there. Because he went, yeah. And you would have thought like he just delivered a Brando-esque monologue. I mean, they lost
He literally shit. Walked onto the stage. They said his name. He walked on the stage. Everybody lost their minds. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't even able to say hello for like probably a good 15 seconds because it was just so loud and uproarious. And I will say out of all of the screenings that I would say probably at any of my South by Southwest screenings, but definitely any of this year, that was the craziest audience. That was the most reactive audience.
That and Evil Dead Rise.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But Evil Dead Rise had a little bit. We'll talk about that in a few.
Had a heckler.
Yeah. Bloody Hell is next. We both saw this. It was written and directed by Molly McGlynn. It's about a teenage girl who gets diagnosed with a reproductive condition that upends her plans to have sex and propels her into exploring unusual methods to have a sex life, challenging her relationships with everyone in her life, but most importantly, herself. It starred Maddie Ziegler, who was in The Fallout, I believe, with Jenna Ortega a couple years ago. Great movie.
Yep.
And also Emily Hampshire. This is the only one of the three that she was in that she showed up for the Q&A. I don't understand what happened with this, but yeah. So what did you think of Bloody Hell? This is more up your alley than probably mine.
Yeah, I mean, this was a personal film to me, I guess I'll say, as a woman who may or may not have issues with conceiving children in the future. I wanted to see what the story could be and how they're approaching it, because part of the way it's marketed and in part of what's in the story is, you know, this is somebody who's young and has a vision for their future of what their life is going to look like. And that includes, you know, being married, having kids, all that good stuff, having sex. And what happens when you feel like your body has betrayed you? And that was actually something that they integrated into this character, is that feeling of betrayal by your body. And I think that was just so powerful. There were so many moments throughout this film where I connected and identified 16-year-old Amanda with this character played by Maddie Ziegler, who was phenomenal in another performance. I mean, she was great in The Fallout, great here. Really looking forward to her career. And Emily Hampshire as her mom, which was hilarious. I probably wouldn't have believed their relationship, but their dynamic, you know, when you see them in person, you're like, I don't think I could see them being mom and daughter. But when you see them on screen, it is so well crafted in their relationship. And they follow those boundaries and character quirks and everything to help you understand their relationship. And having them walk you through the emotions of what a young woman is going through with such a unique condition, which was a very vulnerable and courageous move by the director, Molly, because it's her own story. And so I think that speaks volumes for somebody to be able to put their very intimate, private life on display for everyone too, and do it in such a, I don't want, unbiased way. Like, we never feel like this is a, she's not victimized. She's just a woman who's going through a really horrible situation, but how's she going to get through it? What's her next move? What is she thinking? What are the emotions she's having to overcome? And just the journey of teenage life amidst all of that. I really liked it. So.
All right. What do you give? I give it 550. I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it. But what did you give it?
I mean, anytime I cry, it has to be a minimum 6.
Okay.
Although that feels maybe too easy because I cry pretty often, but I really enjoyed this film and I gave it 650.
All right. And next up is A Disturbance in the Force.
Ooh, I wanted to see this so badly. Jeremy Kuhn and Steve Kozak, who directed this documentary, travel back to a galaxy far, far away. The infamous Star Wars Holiday Special. Dive into the mystery of how it happened and why 45 years later it has become, much to the chagrin of George Lucas, the ultimate cult classic among Star Wars fans. Aaron, you saw this. You said you had a really good time with it. You're not even crazy about documentaries.
Mm-mm.
What was so beloved for this one?
Well, one, I hate the Star Wars Holiday Special. It's one of the biggest pieces of shit I've ever seen in my life. And this film embraces what a piece of shit it is. That right there makes it partly enjoyable. And it's just how Jeremy Kuhn and Steve Kozak cut this. Like, they cut it as the whole film, you always feel like they love Star Wars. They're not making fun of Star Wars. They're just showing how something so bad happened. And they take you through it, through past interviews, newer interviews, diving into merchandising and how the economics of the industry worked at that time. So why things like this happened, how involved George Lucas was, how involved the other cast were, because, you know, all of the actors show up in this, and why it's like 15 minutes without anyone talking but Chewbacca and his family, and what the hell was Life Day? I mean, it just kind of goes through all of the factors that matter to this holiday special. This movie is longer than the holiday special was. It's more entertaining than the holiday special ever was. It is a great documentary on a really horrible fucking special that I'm still mad that our Patreon supporters made us watch.
Well, alrighty then.
And also kind of delighted because we had a great time talking about it. But on the same token, my God, was it awful. But this movie is good. I give it a 7 out of 10.
Awesome.
All right. Swarm. That's a TV show. Prime, March 17th. That is out now. So it's already out. And the description is murder, sex, music. That's it. And it stars Dominique Fishback, Chloe Bailey, and Damson Idris. So what is Swarm? What the hell is Swarm? I've heard a lot of chatter online about it.
Yeah. Well, and all of the South by Southwest shuttles were covered in Swarm.
They were swarmed
posters,
with Swarm,
essentially.
You might say.
They were swarmed with Swarm. So essentially, We have a young-ish character who is obsessed with this artist. Obsessed. Can barely afford to pay the bills, right? Lives with her sister. Her sister's, you know, got a boyfriend. Boyfriend's a little creepy and weird. Seems like he wants to have sex with the younger sister. Creepy and weird. But, she seems legal age and all that. But this obsession goes so far to the point where she's like, I'm gonna just put this on a credit card. And these tickets are hella expensive. We've all been there, right? Ticketmaster, right? Because of your fees. Thank you. And so what she's trying to do is, not only is she obsessed with this artist and she wants to go see them, but she wants to take her sister for her birthday. And her sister has a conflict. The boyfriend wants to take her on a trip. And so she's going to choose the boyfriend and his trip. She thinks it'll be special. And so this kind of unraveling of this character who is kind of shy and reserved, doesn't seem to have too much confrontation. But when she wants to say no to something, she's at least able to say no by just walking away and being quiet. And it's really funny the way that Dominique handles her character. But it goes really freaking off the wall. When they say there's murder, there is murder. There is gory, gory, wild murder that you don't expect. I don't really want to give you much more, but this is a very dark horror television show that is not made for audiences who, I don't know, are sensitive, I guess, because it's going to go in some really crazy directions. And what you realize is this character is has a very deep obsession with certain things. And when a pivotal life event occurs for her, she spirals out of control. And it's what's happening from there. I really enjoyed it. I've seen really good reviews from others in our Facebook group community who've really enjoyed the show since it's come out. So I would highly recommend you check it out. Even though Donald Glover's name is attached to it, which sadly he did not come to South by Southwest, but he had a very funny video. Mm-hmm. He essentially did a cameo where he read his thoughts that were supposed to be very meaningful and impactful about the show, and he read it off of a list as though it was provided to him. So it's very entertaining. But
so what do you give it?
Really, the showrunner, the leader here, is Janine Neighbors. She does a great job. I give it 7.
Excellent. I gotta check that out. I've got so much to watch still.
Well, you saw It Lives Inside already, which was directed by Bishal Dutta. And it is an Indian-American teenager struggling with her cultural identity, has a falling out with her former best friend, and in the process, unwittingly releases a demonic entity that grows stronger by feeding on her loneliness. This cast, that's such a hilarious synopsis to me. The cast is Megan Suri, Nero Bajwa, and some other individuals on the cast list there. Talk to us about this demonic entity that feeds on loneliness. And good thing we didn't have that during COVID.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. The horror elements of this, I don't find really that interesting. It's good, but there's nothing really dramatically different about it. It's pretty much, you've seen this before. It's really the cultural differences that I found fascinating, because I don't know much about Indian culture, and they're really kind of going into this teenager who kind of is casting her Indian heritage aside because she wants to be more focused on being an American. And then this demon starts kind of getting into her life when she starts being more isolated. And it's just a fascinating, it's using horror to kind of break down the differences in culture between a young girl who's really trying too hard to fit in and ignoring who she is, her family roots. You know, she really doesn't want to pay much mind to that. And this demon is really taking advantage of that. So that's the movie in a nutshell. I really like the more personal elements of the film more so than the horror elements, but it's still an interesting horror dynamic. And it really kind of has a father, or not a father, but a mother-daughter arc to it that I think works pretty well. So I give it $6. It's not anything terribly original. I find it interesting.
All right.
Okay. Now the next one. Okay. This was fun. It was directed and co-written.
This was
by
fun.
The Game Night Boys. Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daly. Stars Mr. Chris Pine, who wears sunglasses inside for no reason. Michelle Rodriguez, Regé Jean Page, Justice Smith, Sophia Lillis, and of course, Mr. Hugh Grant. It's Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. A charming thief and a band of unlikely adventurers undertake an epic heist to retrieve a lost relic, but things go dangerously awry when they run afoul of the wrong peeps. Thing is, you love Dungeons and Dragons, the game. You play it all the time. I have no interest whatsoever in it, even though I have played it. I know what it is. I just don't care. So this is a movie that technically is trying to appeal to both of us, and it did. Surprisingly, it did.
Mm-hmm.
The trailers, I remember when the trailers came out and I thought, well, this looks good, but also kind of cheesy. Are these jokes a little lame for this property? I don't know. Then we saw the movie unfold. What say you?
You know, I had the same hesitancies when I saw the trailer. I thought it was going to be cheesy, kind of dumb. And I was like, this is really what they're trying to do with it. But after watching this film, I loved it. It was so great. Not only is this built to appeal to the D&D fanatics, the newbies to D&D, but it also has something for the people who either have zero concept about any of the lore or just have no interest in it necessarily. And so, you know, for anybody who's interested in this or not, it is still an entertaining film for you. They really get into, you know, helping you understand, and the actors do such a great job of what these characters, traits are essentially, so you can really understand who they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to operate. And so, for example, when you have somebody like Chris Pine, who's playing a bard, you realize, oh, okay, this is a guy who plays a three-stringed instrument. He's very entertaining. He's very energetic. He has great charisma. And he exudes that through his performance. And every single person does that as well. And they have all the creatures and the features and the monsters, the traps, the things that you want to see as a D&D fan. Those fan favorites are here. And it is fun as hell. Fun as hell.
So fun as hell?
Fun as hell, man.
Well, I got to say, I mean, I didn't catch a lot of the in-jokes and the in-references and all that stuff. I don't know. I couldn't tell you anything about the game. I played it a couple times with the friends. It's just, it's actually kind of fun. I don't have the investment in it. I always feel like I'm out on a limb when I try to play. But when you're watching it, it makes you kind of want to play the game. Like, man, this game is obviously more fun than I realize. But whatever. It's a fun movie. Yeah. It's, I guess, a family movie. What it reminds me of are like fantasy movies from the 80s. Better special effects, better talent, that sort of thing. But like the Willow vibe and things like that. Movies back from the 80s, when they made fantasy films, they were fun. They might have had a dire stakes and that sort of thing, but ultimately it was a fun movie. It was enjoyable from start to finish. And they don't make many of those now. Every fantasy film today is really serious. From Lord of the Rings to Game of Thrones, everything is just dark and dour, and the end of the world is, you know, at stake. And it's just, you know, there's no fun in it. There's no laughs. There's no joy. This is fun. And it's not cheap laughs. I know the trailer kind of made it seem like it was a lot of cheap. It's not. There's a lot of funny stuff in here, a lot of clever stuff, a lot of character stuff. Each character really does have an arc. And man, the entire cast works in every respective role. I had an absolute blast. That's 850 for me.
850 for me, too. There's two things I want to mention to you guys. One, the love interest of Michelle Rodriguez, although it's an incredibly small role, it is so fun.
Yeah, that's a joy. Yep.
So fun. The other thing is there is a tremendously fantastic one-shot scene that transitions a character into multiple different iterations that she's capable of doing because of her character. And it was, I think you really enjoyed it too, but it was phenomenal how it was shot, how it was executed. Sophia Lillis really did a great job in her performance in that, but it really came down to like the cinematography and the directing on that. The production of that one shot scene was phenomenal.
Yeah, I like I said, start to finish, it was fun and enjoyable from start to finish. But also, I enjoyed the characters. Like at the end of the movie, I want to see more of them. And also got a little teary-eyed. The end has a little teary-eyed in there. Little, you know.
Oh yeah, I cried. Of course, I was
that
crying.
Gets you over 6 with Amanda right there, right off the bat.
Exactly.
Me too. Tear gets you over 8 for me. That's how this works. If you can get a tear out of me, you're doing great. Oh, next is a movie that didn't get any tears. But first, how about a little Q&A from Dungeons & Dragons? We'll find out what they would be, what roles they would have if each of the actors were actually part of Dungeons & Dragons.
Ah.
No, DM, that's Hugh Grant's role, right?
Even if I wanted to be a DM, I wouldn't admit it. Because then I'd seem like an egomaniacal creature. You know what I mean? I kind of wish I were a DM, but I wouldn't.
You would be
so
the gremlinest DM of all time.
Well, after watching Chris be a bard, I want to be a bard. Because, you know, directing a movie is essentially like running a campaign, and you have to keep everybody motivated, keep all the trains running on time. And I was really, I got kind of an education from him on what that is and how to be indefatigable and unstoppable. And we wrote so much new stuff because Chris brought that to the role.
Yeah!
I would be Paladin because I want to be that guy. I hate him, bro.
I'm a producer, so I think probably fall into the rogue category, for better or for worse. But I try to be a paladin at all times. That's the aspiration.
Be in the heart of a warrior.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I love being a bard so much. So much. No preparation. Lots of smiling. Throw me a three-string instrument. And I'll get to work.
Well, we happen to have one right here.
I think I would definitely go druid with it, just because I love nature so much. And I gotta say, though, what you guys did, bro, with the tiefling / you know, owlbear, like, yo, what's up with that? Is that even like a thing?
That's also
that's new.
It's that's a
like,
thing.
I never remember playing and hearing that I could be one of those.
You can now.
You can now.
Change the rules.
Yeah, I think I'd go with that, man. That's awesome. Sick.
What about that wild magic? I take Simon's job. I think the fresh cut grass can solve any problem.
I would also be myself.
Isn't that what it's all about?
I would be probably a cleric, because that's one thing that definitely this group lacked. I'll take that role.
I think I'd be a druid too. I think the possibilities are endless. Sophia did it pretty bloody well. So.
Claudette can DM then, since you don't have a DM.
Yeah, I'll have to learn more about it. This has definitely inspired me to finally join my friends who've asked me for many years. So I appreciate the inspiration.
All right, we're on to Chronicles of a Wandering Saint. This was directed and written by Thomas Gomez Bustillo, and in a tiny rural village in Argentina, Rita Lopez, a pious yet insatiably competitive woman, discovers that staging a miracle could be her ticket to sainthood. This stars Monica Villa as, I presume, the Rita Lopez. Talk to us a little bit about Chronicles of a Wandering Saint.
I'll be brief here because I did not enjoy this film. The concept is really great. The performances are well done. I love the idea of someone basically taking advantage of the possibility of miracles, and totally could see the real world doing it, especially someone who's kind of led a small life and now suddenly this would give them a greater existence to many people, right? It makes you, it puts you on the top of shoulders as opposed to cleaning up after them. And that's really what the movie's about. It's just incredibly slow. It's incredibly slow paced. It takes forever to get moving and gain momentum. And that pacing really makes it hard for me to stay with it. But again, I mean, I love the concept and the performances were strong. It's just, it's a very leisurely paced film that did not work for me overall. So I give it 450. Now, we went and saw, it's actually a sequel to a movie neither one of us had seen the original to. So the funny thing is...
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah, right?
And I don't think it really mattered. I mean, I feel like they give you a recap at the beginning. We got the gist of it. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's called The Wrath of Becky. It's a sequel to Becky. And it has Lulu Wilson and Sean William Scott and Mad Angel. And after living off the grid for 2 years, Becky finds herself going toe-to-toe against Daryl, the leader of a fascist organization on the eve of an organized attack. So talk to me about The Wrath of Becky. Since you didn't see it, I think I enjoyed it about as much as you did. So tell me what you thought of writer-director Matt Angel's return to Becky, which we didn't really know was a return.
So Wrath of Becky was fun. It was bloody. It had, I don't want to say necessarily an interesting story. That might not be the right words to use there, but I appreciated how we got this character from point A to point B, from 0 to 100.
It's a revenge story.
And yeah, it is. And this definitely appeals to me. I love that. One of my favorite like subgenres is female revenge films. I just love them. And I really enjoyed this. I did think that it needed a little bit more impact in the climax towards the end of the film. Could have hit it a little bit stronger, a little bit harder. The movie concluded and I was like, oh,
yep,
that's about the end of it.
Yep, about the same.
So that, just for that reason, it really kind of took it down for me. And my score is 550.
My score is 5. It's enjoyable enough, though. And I like Lulu Wilson. I think she was great.
She absolutely was.
Raging Grace. That was an audience favorite from South by Southwest. I believe it won an audience award. A bold coming-of-age story where Joy, a Filipino immigrant, and her daughter Grace encounter a darkness that threatens all they have worked for. Stars Maxine Eggman, Leanne Best, David Heyman, and was written and directed by Pans Zarsila. So what? Why are people raving about Raging Grace?
I don't know if I'm the right person to ask that question to. Let me say this. I really liked the movie. I don't know. There are others that I think I would have probably put up there for an award over Raging Grace, but I did like it. It had
She's very angry because it's
it.
A coming of rage story, right?
You're funny. I don't know. This is not really what I would consider a coming of age story. So it's just kind of clever synopsis writing. But essentially, we have this woman, this mother, who is now going to be a live-in housekeeper, and she sneaks her daughter in, and she's caring for this man who has cancer, who's not been conscious, really. I mean, he's not been alert in quite a while. And so his aunt is the one who's kind of leading the household and paying this woman. And there's some discrepancies, some questions about, you know, is this aunt keeping this man sick or is he actually sick and how are they going to respond to that? And of course, when you throw a little kid into the mix, they always screw shit up. And so things go really off the rails. What I think is fantastic about this film is its execution of score in really impactful moments. The production overall was really well done, and it did have an interesting story, but it also is not incredibly unique in many ways. So for that reason, I give it 650. I did like it. You should check it out if it comes to you, near you. I think it'll probably get some sort of distribution somehow with the awards it won, but...
Well, I definitely want to see it because they called it a coming of rage story. That's enough for me to check it out.
Yeah, there's some cool moments in it.
Well, I hope there's some ragey moments because it's called Raging Grace and it's a coming of rage story. There better be some rage, is what I'm saying.
The Artifice Girl is directed and written by Franklin Richt, and it is about three special agents who develop a bold new computer program to catch online predators, but its rapid advancement poses unexpected challenges, and it stars Tatum Matthews, Cinda Nichols, and Franklin Richt is in it also,
Rich.
The director.
Franklin Rich.
Rich. Yep. Rich. Artifice Girl is one we both really wanted to check out. You got the opportunity to see it. Mm-hmm. Did it live up to hopes and expectations?
Yeah, and I didn't know what to expect because I really didn't know much about it except I liked the synopsis. It had that Ex Machina vibe, and I'm a big fan of Ex Machina, Alex Garland's Ex Machina, which also debuted at South by Southwest. This was an interesting film. I really enjoyed it. It's much more of a thinker and also a very small film. It's basically broken into three acts, and each act is a different moment in time. And it's really like three or four people in a room talking. And I don't want to give anything away because it's really an experience film. You got to go through it to kind of get where they're going with it. But the idea, I'll give you the central concept. So someone develops an advanced AI that will help them trap predators, online predators. And that advanced AI is created so that it can evolve, so that when the AI is speaking with an online predator, they can react, they can adjust, they can modify speech patterns and responses and that sort of thing, so that the predator can't tell that this is AI. The idea is, to them, it appears to be a young girl, right? Now, what happens when that AI evolves, when it grows, when it continues to learn? How does that affect the people that are using it, the program itself? You know, it's not as big and broad as Ex Machina was. It's not as big and broad. You know, that had a similar kind of concept, but it went much bigger. This is a much smaller construct and really looking at, can AI feel? Can AI adapt to feelings? Can it really pass the Turing test? And I thought it was an incredibly complex and an engaging film that you will leave and want to talk to people about. And to me, that's always a high bar and one very few films ever get to. So I give it $7. It's definitely worth checking out, The Artifice Girl, which it is getting distribution sometime this year. Now, you and I both saw Furies, about a mysterious woman who trains a trio of girls to take revenge on a criminal gang that abuses females. The three lady warriors risk everything to challenge this corrupt empire before finally learning that their cause is not what they believed it to be. And it has quite the cast. It's directed by Veronica Ngo. And I want to say, so, Furies. It's basically John Wick with three ladies.
Yep. That's about
you
it.
We love revenge films. I think we both felt about the same on this one. I think this one has a really cool twist that I will not spoil, but I love where it goes in the course of the film. And I had a blast. The fighting's fun. I mean, you can tell like the budget's a little more limited than a big budget movie, but it's a lot of fun and the action is nonstop.
Yeah, and the choreography of the action is really great, too. So it doesn't feel like a low-budget film by any means in terms of that. The cast is really well-rounded, really, really, really liked the three girls and their chemistry.
It's like Charlie's Angels with ass-kicking.
It truly is. It's so funny because there's so much that, and we had seen this shortly, few days after John Wick? Mm-hmm. I think it was 2 days. And it's just so funny because you can see the similarities in there, but it's definitely made for, I shouldn't say it's made for women. It has an appeal for women, for a female audience to connect to. So I definitely resonated with it. I thought it was fun and action-packed, and it is subtitled, but don't let that dissuade you from seeing it. You really should check it out if you get the opportunity.
I personally usually avoid subtitle films. This didn't bother me at all. And each of the characters has a unique personality, which is nice because they didn't feel like cardboard cutouts. Good film. Okay. Puro. Amanda, you saw this. I did not see this. Young screenwriter and musician grapples with Puro, a lesser-known form of OCD, while juggling his recent engagement and his day job at a high-end Malibu drug rehab. It's inspired by the filmmaker's own true personal story. It was directed and written by Dylan Tucker, and it stars Daniel Doerr, Hope Lauren, Landry Bender, and more. So I remember you raved about this one. Why?
So many reasons. I did not intend to go to the screening at this time. I had interest in seeing the film, but there was something else that I was trying to catch at that time. Ended up not making it. And so I went into one that was just a couple minutes after and made that one fine. And that was pure O. And so I was like, hey, this works out because I wanted to see this one anyway. And I'm curious what it's about. And kind of went in as blind as I think I possibly could. And that's when I realized this one is going to be pretty special. If you remember, what was it last year that you saw, or we both saw, what was it, Violet?
Yes. Yeah, Violet. I love Violet. Yep.
And you know how impactful that was from like a mental health standpoint? Mm-hmm. That's how this is, but not in a dark way. Like there's so much that you can relate to, or I could relate to, I should only speak for myself, not every audience member, that I could relate to. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting because you normally don't see this. Not only are you understanding this man's struggles, while he has, for the most part, a pretty normal, healthy, standard life, you know, he doesn't have incredibly, I don't know, problematic scenarios occurring, but he has this mental health disorder. He's also a rehabilitation counselor, an addiction counselor. And so he's not unfamiliar with understanding diseases and how they affect the brain, but he is a little resistant. He's like, I don't think I have OCD. What are you talking about? Like, I don't have these ticks on doors. And so it's flipping our perspectives, our assumptions, and what we know about OCD and flipping it on its back to say, but what about the mental compulsions? What about our mental capacity where for those who have OCD or obsessive tendencies, it may not be a physical compulsion that you have. It could be in your brain. And like this movie, I swear, unlocked things for me, like from a knowledge standpoint and a realization standpoint of so many different things. And beyond that, they also show the journey of him going through therapy and like recovering through this and recovering through suicidal thoughts. And they handle that so perfectly. I was so impressed with how they handled that, with it not being so incredibly dark that it triggers someone or, you know, it's too much or too heavy. They managed to make it funny and kind of give you hope at the end of the day. And there was just so much about this movie that worked on top of the amazing cast, who did a phenomenal job. And we have a real life couple playing the couple in this story. And I think that that definitely helped with us buying into that story. But tremendous film. I highly, highly, highly recommend you check it out if you get the opportunity to.
Okay. And that's pure O. And also, Amanda also saw With Love in a Major Organ. And then we've got one more after that. Evil Dead Rise is after that. So hang tight. But With Love in a Major Organ, in a world, this description goes on, so just breathe. In a world where everyone's heart is an object and there's a strong societal pressure to dampen emotion, lonely virtual insurance broker Annabelle always follows her heart. At odds with this overly pragmatic society, and after a series of devastating emotional blows, she rips her heart from her chest and gives it to a man she's fallen for, the strangely unfeeling George. Unburdened by her unique yet cumbersome heart, Annabelle finds life easier. George, on the other hand, begins to feel everything to the shock of his overbearing mother, Mona. Annabelle soon realizes she needs to get her heart back if she's going to survive. It's directed by Kim Albright and stars Anna Maguire and others. And I got to ask, does she literally rip her chest out, her heart from her chest?
So it's such a... This is a very artsy film. There is so much art ingrained in it. She does literally rip her heart out. So this is what? A world where your heart... Listen, Linda. Yeah. This is a world where your heart is made out of like an inanimate object. But it's also an object that it's like something that you could find in your home, like a lamp. Or it could also be something like a crab or, you know, a creature like a turtle or something. So everybody has their own unique, quote unquote, heart don't think of it as a traditional harp, but it's something that keeps you together and you need it to survive. And so when this, she observes a man literally ripping his heart out from his chest, and there's kind of like a glowing sensation to it and all that good stuff. And he throws it in the river, and he goes from crying, sobbing to being completely numb. And it's just the most bizarre thing she's seen. So when she endures pain and heartbreak, she said, screw it. I'm not doing this. I saw that I can get rid of this. The problem is, in this world, you still need your heart to survive. And so while this is very artsy and animated in that capacity, it still is teaching you such a great lesson about the emotional vulnerability and the courage that it takes to be an emotionally vulnerable person, the courage it takes to not keep yourself walled off, to not numb yourself out to pain and to other feelings of joy and happiness and things like that. And that if you do numb out the bad things, you're also numbing out the good things. And this was actually originally a play that was developed for this film, translated into it. And they made adjustments where they have like an app integrated where your whole life is basically programmed and ran by this AI technology. There's so much AI in South by Southwest in 2023. But essentially, it knows you better than you know yourself. And people let that run their life. So it's interesting. It has conversations about our real life societal place, but it has this one analogy in the beginning, which broke my heart into pieces. And I just want to share that super briefly. She talks about how a piece of yarn is like your heart. And what her mom taught her is as she would walk through the forest, it would catch and snag on trees, on people. And even though you would continue moving along, you'd always have that snag on that tree. And then the next tree and the next tree. And so it really is talking about like the emotional, humanistic, I don't know, our capacity for love and what that does to us and the impact of that. I really liked it. So that is one that I will give 5.50 to. It's a little too artsy for my liking, but I love the message behind it.
Okay. Now take us to Evil Dead Rise. Finally.
Let's take it out. Evil Dead Rise tells a twisted tale of two estranged sisters played by Lily Sullivan and Alyssa Sutherland. And these two sisters have a reunion that's cut short by the rise of flesh-possessing demons, thrusting them into a primal battle for survival as they face the most nightmarish version of family imaginable. Directed and written by Lee Cronin. More importantly, no offense, executive producers include Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell, the OGs. Aaron, we love Evil Dead as a franchise.
I do. Yep.
You love Evil Dead. You love Sam Raimi. You love Bruce Campbell. Did you have to change your pants?
No, I didn't have to change my pants, but this continues the franchise's perfect record as far as I'm concerned. They haven't made a bad film in this franchise, and I'm including the TV show in that. Like, it's just all around good. Director Lee Cronin finally takes the franchise out of the cabin in the woods. You know, I'm not counting the show in this. In terms of the features, they're always the cabin in the woods or the medieval times, whatever. But here they're out of it. They're actually going down to Midtown. They're in an apartment complex. This family's being evicted. And, of course, somebody, you know, I agree the circumstances are a little wonky in terms of how they get to the book. But they get to the Book of the Dead. The Necronomicon is there. If people that don't know, that book is basically wrapped in human flesh, written in blood. And if you read from it, you're going to awaken the evil dead who essentially possess you and make all of your loved ones do horrible things to themselves and to you. And there's lots of that, including you're never going to not give your cheese grater some side eye after this movie. So it's a very intense, visceral film. I liked that they really made it about a family and that they had some kids in here. None of the kids are safe either. Like, nobody's safe. You don't know who's going to lose a limb, who's going to get mauled, who's going to get just carved up. There's blood everywhere. There's a freaking homage to The Shining. I could have done without that, but I also don't like The Shining. Apparently Bruce Campbell is hidden somewhere in here. I did not see him, so I got to watch this movie again and again and again until I can find him. And the performances from Melissa Sutherland and Lily Sullivan are what really carry the movie. Ellie is kind of forced to confront her demons early on, so to speak. And I think Sutherland gives possibly the best take on what on a deadite since Bruce Campbell got into a pissing match with his own hand. I really love her take on that. And Sullivan also has a lot of strong aspects to her performance that really just do wonders in the film. Like those two were so good. They really just, they were here to play. And lots of practical effects. Oh, I love the practical effects. And if you do them well in a horror movie, awesome. You can also use digital and it blends seamlessly. It's when the over-reliance on digital effects never works. This has a nice blending.
Yeah, it was so much ridiculous fun. There were so many elements that tie back to the original that remind you of, you know, the specifics. I think there are a couple things that were a little loosey-goosey in terms of plot points, how we got to certain things. I really, really enjoyed our lead ladies here, Lily and Alyssa. They knocked it out of the park. I will probably never forget her face when she says, "Mommy's with the maggots now." But there were so many really wonderful moments, and I love the way the film wraps up. So I did enjoy it. Nothing will top the original, but you know, this was still a really fun film.
Yeah, and all the tones are kind of different with the Evil Dead movies. This is kind of, the last remake was more of the tone of the first Evil Dead, where it was straight horror, grim and dire. This one is really a good vibe of Evil Dead 2, which is a nice horror comedy mix. There's a lot of jokes in here. And, you know, Mommy's with the Maggots now. She also has a lot of, like, just humor and how she approaches the deadite. So I'm telling you, she's great. Her and Bruce Campbell should do a deadite duo movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, hell yeah.
I'd love it. So what do you give it? If $10 is the full price of admission, what do you give Evil Dead Rise?
8 out of 10.
Okay, I give it $7.50. This is a top-notch take on Evil Dead. And we're going to cut to the moment that's probably infamous at this point, but during the Q&A panel for Evil Dead Rise, there was a heckler that was, some people thought it was rigged or something. It was not. This,
like a stunt. Yeah, it was not a stunt. This man was drunk, passed out. Even before they started the panel, his feet were literally dangling over the edge because he was on like a balcony seating and he was passed out. And they called him out because they were laughing at him before they really started the panel. Like, haha, this drunk dude's just like chilling. And so that's when the theater staff approached him. This was not an elaborate plan to get Bruce Campbell
to yell at
on somebody. Variety. The man has a wonderful reputation. I don't think he needed this.
But he also is one of,
sure as hell, I'm glad he did.
He's one of the best. And I was telling Amanda, because you hadn't seen him in person before, right?
Yeah. No, I was so excited
I told her before we got there, I'm like, look, there's nobody that will chastise his own fans better than Bruce Campbell. Like, he just has a way of, he can make fun of you or he can chastise you, and he can just own the room. There's just something about him where he knows how to work a room like that. He's very sardonic and that sort of thing. And this guy, of course, you know, got mad because he was being asked to leave the theater, and he shouted that this movie fucking sucks. And Bruce Campbell shot him down. He's like giving him deuce middle fingers and dual middle fingers and telling him to shut the fuck up. And you're going to hear that. So enjoy this gem, because I'm also going to leave part of it in where you hear how awkward it was, so you know it wasn't a stunt, because the whole Q&A was turning bad. Like, it really got uncomfortable. And then Bruce Campbell, like he has done in many of the Evil Dead films, he saved the day.
Were they properly prepared for how much intense physical activity was going to be in this production?
Fuck no!
Fuck no! I was, I read the script. I knew what was coming.
They were sitting around all day just like, you know. No, they worked their ass off.
Yeah, they fucking worked their ass off. No, I mean, you know,
I saw 20 pages of covered in blood, which ended up being a month covered in blood. The most sticky, icky, disgusting 6 month old in the end, because it was COVID, we ran out of blood in New Zealand because they couldn't import it. So that batch that you saw in the elevator that was 6 months old, they'd be like, Lil, this will do, yeah? By the end of the shoot. So I had like old stanky brew, not like a fine wine. It was, yeah.
Yeah, you recycle that shit, it's expensive.
You recycle that shit. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, nothing can be prepared for. I mean, you were prepared, I was not prepared. Okay.
Yeah, but I come from the world of fashion where they do like even more fucked up shit to you, so this was a dream. Yeah, we have a union as actors.
Watch us now.
I get to clock out.
Was there anything in the script that you read and you're like, well, surely this is going to get rewritten? Like, he can't pull this off. We're not going to do this.
There's one line, which is my favorite line of the movie, which I know we talked about and you weren't sure, and I was like, just do it, it'll be great, and you trusted me and I appreciate that, which is the titty-sucking parasites line. we gotta get that on a t-shirt, right? That's her face, that line on a t-shirt. What else can happen? But technically, no, like, one of the great things about working with the guys is their wealth of experience making horror movies. And if anything, they were always pushing for more. There was never any sense of, hey, peel back. And I think in making an Evil Dead movie, you have to put it right in fifth gear, like immediately. First to fifth and kind of go. So there's nothing we really cut out aggressively. I can't remember anyway.
But even, not counting the edit, but in production, on the production side, were there gags, were there setups that you were afraid you weren't actually going to deliver on, and then when you saw the dailies, you're like, holy fucking shit.
I mean, did you see the monster?
We like to call that, by the way, everybody, the Marauder. Just so everybody knows.
We held the elevator scene over Lee's head to try and get the schedule to work. What's that?
Fucking sucks.
Whoa! He's storming out. He's storming like a 7-year-old.
Can't please
this guy. I think that means we made it. He's gone. Everybody's gone.
I think someone got possessed during the movie. I think that's what happened.
Yeah.
What are you doing here? Get the fuck out of here.
Don't talk to Bruce like
keep,
that!
Keep Austin weird, right?
There was no alcohol involved in that whatsoever.
I don't get it. He waited all the way through the credits.
All right, well, that asshole aside, I think we can all agree that this movie actually really fucking rules.
All right, Amanda, that is Jesus. That's a lot. We're done. We are done. No more movies. We're done. I don't want to watch anything for a while.
Goodbye.
Yeah. Well, we've got a couple awards, so we're going to just go through these quick, okay? We're going to give our own South by Southwest awards. We do this in every time we do one of these episodes. So I'm just going to go through just your quick hit, right? So don't go too complicated. Most unique film you saw?
With Love and a Major Organ. That's one where she rips her heart out of her chest.
Okay.
Super unique.
That's super unique. Self-Reliance, I think, was my most unique. It was just kind of a cool idea, you know. Best new to you director. Doesn't even have to be a new director, just new to you.
I went with Paris Zarsila, who did Raging Grace. I love the production of that film and the direction. Thought it was great. And I will also add to you, and I mentioned this to you, Aaron, and this is super quick. This director didn't just wait for the Q&A. Normally, they'll just go and stand in the front. This director went and greeted every single person that walked out of that theater and told them, thank you for coming to see my movie. That was the most phenomenal thing I've ever seen.
Respect. You got my respect.
Tons.
Best New to Me director was Talk to Me directors Danny and Michael Filippo. It was a cool concept, and they really worked the horror angle and really, really showcased that how dumb people are, because they would totally do this. Best overall performance from any film.
I'm going with a television.
That's fine.
Actually,
that's fine.
Swarm, Dominique Fishback.
That good, huh?
Phenomenal performance. That shit had me tweaking. I was like, what is going on here? She is so good.
Check this out. It's on Prime, right? Swarm. It's on Prime.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'll check it out this weekend. Mine is Sophie Wilde from Talk to Me. You know, I mentioned it earlier. She hits every gamut of emotion. She's all over the place. You don't know whether to love her or hate her, and that's a lot of what makes that movie work. And her performance just captivated me. I remembered it throughout the entire festival. And that's saying something, because that was one of the first movies I saw. Film you heard get the most buzz but didn't get to see. I will tell you, Raging Grace. I didn't get to see that, but I heard a ton about it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mine was a toss-up. I really wanted to see Parachute, which was Brittany Snow's new film that came out. And then I Used to Be Funny, which had Rachel Sennott, who was in Bottoms that we talked about earlier, the Fight Club girl movie. And I heard I Used to Be Funny was phenomenal, but I just did not get a chance to see it, and I'm sad.
All right. Favorite all-around film, and we're going to break it into popular and indie, just so both get their due. What is your favorite popular film of the festival that you saw?
Favorite is going to be Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves.
And I mean that by like mainstream, headliner, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Mine's John Wick Chapter 4, because damn.
Of course. Yeah.
I was kind of bummed Evil Dead Rise didn't make our top for either one of us, but...
Dungeons and Dragons was just, it was so entertaining to me, and it was something I was looking forward to more than Evil Dead Rise. So.
All right. Festival film. Indie. More indie.
Puro. That's the one about the OCD.
I got to see that. That sounds fantastic.
You got it. You would love it. It's so good.
Mine's The Long Game, which, again, I mean, it's not an indie in the sense of years past where I was like focused on, wow, that's like really like Everything Everywhere All at Once, or Violet, where things just felt like that's a deeper take on something. This is a pretty, I won't say by the numbers, but a pretty by the numbers take on a sports movie and overcoming odds. I just think they handled it beautifully, and it was really well done. And it's a story I haven't seen told. Okay, that's it. Dear God.
Fair enough.
Any closing thoughts on the festival, the experience? Anything.
I'm ready to go back, but I do need some recovery time.
The food. I do want to shout out to Austin's food scene, because they have
lots
of food.
Yeah, the food is even better when your DoorDasher delivers it to the right place, to the right hotel.
Yeah, you ordered tacos one night and never got it right.
But eat tacos! And I didn't get them! I did get my money back, so
we got a pizza that was kind of eh. But...
Bro, I don't know what was going on with that pizza. The pepperoni was like in long strips. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, but you know what? That's the thing, is when you're doing these film festivals, when you're trying to hit three or four movies in a day, it's, you know, you got to keep moving. You don't get to eat until, you know, later that night. So you get what you get.
Unless you go see a movie at the Alamo. Oh. Then yeah. Alamo Lamar, then you got to be smart. You got to plan that for like the middle, beginning part of your day, or actually like the afternoon, because then you can get lunch and then you're good for like a long time.
Yeah. And there's two things, right? So the Paramount Theater, in terms of the theaters, because they're across the different places in the city of Austin, the Paramount Theater is the best theater to see a big headliner movie, because the crowd is wild.
Oh, yeah. Else.
The Alamo is the best place to go when you want to see a small, quiet indie and you haven't eaten all day, because you can enjoy it. You get drinks at the highball bar, and you also can eat. Dear God, they have food you can eat.
Man, real quick mention. Shout out to Alamo Draft House, who had a Dungeons and Dragons tavern in their building. They transformed their bar into a D&D tavern, cool. And it was so damn cool.
That was cool.
So cool.
I got to see Chris Pine.
Yeah, you did.
In that bar, and he was wearing sunglasses again.
Speaking of the D&D lead, one of his counterparts, Regé Jean Page, if you want to see him hug and kiss a super fan because he is the most amazing man on planet Earth, and then see that woman fall down, presumably because she got kissed on the forehead by him, for a picture, again, because he's magnificent, go to the Hollywood Outsiders TikTok and you can catch that video.
Yeah, we don't do much with TikTok, but that was a TikTok-worthy performance right there.
Man, what a sweet stand-up dude.
Although I was kind of like irritated, like, really, this is what you're going to ask for? And of course, he obliged. I thought that was going to encourage a lot more of that, but thankfully, it did not.
Thankfully, it didn't. Although, you know what? I'm not going to lie. If I could have done that for Michelle Rodriguez, she probably was drunk enough that she would have come down and given me a hug,
yes,
too.
And if you go to our Patreon, we will be having, on our Patreon, we will have a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff from the festival that we can't play or air here. So you can go to patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. That's patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. There's stuff that's going to be coming more over the next month, so keep an eye on that. I won't tell you what there is, but there's already some Dungeons & Dragons stuff, so go check that out.
And if you don't believe Aaron's The Gunfather and how tremendous it is, you can believe all the other Rotten Tomatoes critics, his peers, because it is now the highest rated movie of the franchise.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Among Rotten Tomatoes critics. That's crazy.
Isn't that wild?
All right, goodbye.
There were a lot of movies to look for, and now I hope you have a few things to keep an eye out for. You might have to re-listen to this episode a few times, but keep in mind, many of these films do not yet have a release date, so check IMDb for updates. Thank you for listening, everybody. Be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Outsider. We're available at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Tell your friends about The Hollywood Outsider, and remember, the next time you head to a theater, buy popcorn. Nap time.
Good night.